Okay, actually, I'm going to speak more specifically about the so-called projected SFI theory of high-TC superconductivity. So I'll report in particular on two developments I'm sure Susheng Zhang has not discussed in any great detail in his talk, but which we find very interesting and very crucial, also showing positive as well as negative signs of this, in principle, very beautiful idea of the SFI theory. The projection, as you will see, means that we have to account for the Mott-Hubbard gap physics, which was initially not accounted for in the SFI theory. And I will discuss two issues. One is the fermionic issue, so I will discuss fermionic excitations, and in particular, Arpis experiments, as these experiments are related to such a theory. And in fact, we believe that the Arpis experiments give a very crucial check or as a prescription for any microscopic theory, not just the SFI theory. And I will hopefully convince you that Hubbard and TJ models, and in this respect, I have some hope that you will take something away even if you're not on my side, Hubbard and TJ models miss some important physics. And we believe that the missing piece can be constructed and formulated in terms of symmetry arguments. And then in the second part of my talk, I will in particular discuss new, very new numerical results, which present an exact solution of the quantum nonlinear sigma model on a lattice, which carries this projected SFI theory. So in order to warm you up, let me first of all briefly repeat basically what I just said, namely what I will discuss here. I will start out with the conventional exact old ideas of the SFI theory. I will turn to problems, and in particular I will indicate the problems on the fermionic Arpis data, so this will be my first part. Then I will construct a bosonic Hamiltonian which deals with the more general physics of the phase diagram, and also I will discuss problems here, which means the inclusion of the Mott-Hubbard gap physics. And this was discussed so far in terms of mean field results, probably also in Susheng Zhang's talk, and I was away at that time. But I will present the very new exact solutions of that problem. Okay, so let me go into the SFI description as it was initially conjectured mathematically by Susheng Zhang. And I don't have to really dive into this in great detail. I'm sure you all know that the basic idea is we have a close proximity of anti-ferromagnetic and superconducting phases. And the basic idea is that this can be incorporated into a symmetry principle in the sense that one would like to somehow phrase it as anti-ferromagnetic and superconducting states, although being very different, in one way or another, which we have to make more precise, are two faces of the same coin. And what was initially mathematically Susheng Zhang discussed is that this can be done by looking at the order parameter for the anti-ferromagnet, which is a three-dimensional vector governing or following the SO3 rotations, and unifying this with the two-component superconducting order parameter, the real and imaginary part of the gap order parameter, and thereby one has a new Lie algebra, a new symmetry group, which is SO5, which has as a subgroup SO3 times U1, but really involves these rotations, and in that sense it is more than SO3 times U1. In particular, it maps you from the superconducting to the anti-ferromagnetic state in terms of a rotation of this vector. Okay, so this is all I want to say to the old ideas, basically.
Will you be telling us that PSO5 is a subgroup of SO5?
No, I will. Let me really describe it. If this is not clear when you go out, then I have totally missed my talk here. I hope I can convince you completely what does the projection to the old description and in which way it is modified. So this is the main topic here. So let me, however, go a little bit further and speak in particular about the physical picture behind SO5. This was our main motivation when I first heard of this mathematical idea at home. I was fascinated, but I said there must be some physics behind it. And this is what we really considered and worked on it. And there's a very relevant paper by a postdoc in my group, Robert Eder, and I would like to discuss this paper as, again, a warm-up into the physics and then also into the problems related with SO5. So what Robert Eder basically could show is that you have two kinds of condensation processes which can account basically for this type of phase diagram. He started out with a spin liquid. In fact, he took a short-range RVB state composed out of spin-liquid dimers in x and y direction at half filling, and then he said I can have two type of modifications of this background gray spin-liquid. I can have excitations of these singlets into magnons or triplet excitations, and he showed that these magnons can move through the spin-liquid in a very characteristic manner. So this is the calculated dispersion. So basically what he did is he takes a short-range RVB, two-dimensional description, and looks at the dispersion of this magnon. And this disperses to zero at a characteristic Bragg wave vector pi pi. This is a short-range RVB, and I'm not going to discuss this in detail. This is just to give you some flavor. If you are interested in any detail, you look at this paper, but I can directly tell you what it did. So he took a short-range RVB.
Was it S plus ID? What kind of RVB?
This is a nearest neighbor RVB, where you have a superposition in X and Y directions of these singlets, and they are statistically distributed, and he deals with the statistics of that in 2D, which is non-trivial. Okay? I'm not going into this. Let me just do this as a warm-up, as an idea, because this is not my main topic.
The thing I don't understand is, how does that come to zero? And that's Goldstone codes that cause it to come to zero. But this state is a state of non-broken symmetry.
This comes to zero in this calculation if it goes really to the two-dimensional plane and extends it to a large system, and this is discussed in detail in this paper here.
Does this short-range RVB state actually have hidden long-range order?
It has long-range order if, then this is exactly what I'm driving at, since these magnons are hardcore bosons, I can condense then the hardcore bosons into this lowest energy state.
Does this state have long range?
Yeah, let me just write it down for you. If he takes, for example, the C triplets and writes down a coherent state where he creates out of the short range RVB S equal 1, S equal 2, and so on states out of this, he gets an anti-ferromagnetic state which has long range order.
Yeah. Well, I remember what he does is he starts with that short-range RVB state as a trial state and look at stability, look at triplet fluctuations. They go down energy around pi pi. So it's telling that the system will go anti-ferromagnetic. And what Werner has written is the condensed state.
Okay, so it's not in the RVB state, it's in some state with a condensate.
So this is the state which gives you the RVB. So the RVB is the vacuum, if you like. Okay,
if you do this to the actual short-range RVB state, then the resulting state would have finite energy phenomena.
Well, again, I just want to get your interest, because this is not my topic. He shows in detail, numerically and as well as analytically, that the spin on the conventional excitations are not the lowest excitations. The lowest excitations are really the magnon excitations. If you don't believe, have a look at this. I just want to tell you this is an interesting paper. The other idea now, which brings me really to SO5, is that if I now were to replace these triplets here, let me just say I could replace this via some pi operator and go to the corresponding zero momentum Cooper pairs. then I would create obviously a similar coherent state, and this is a superconducting state. So this idea would be that via doping change in the chemical potential, if via a pi rotation I can go from the magnons to the hole pairs, I might get a very physical connection in the sense of SO5, that I formally have a similar state, namely a coherent state describing on the one hand the antiferromagnet, and if I replace the triplets by Cooper pairs, I'm going to the superconducting state.
So I don't fully understand now. I mean, the state you have here at the bottom of the transparency actually has long range order.
So let me write it down in a different picture, which you... This was the strong coupling picture.
Well, how do you mention about the previous view graph?
I didn't even write down this beyond this local sketchy picture, but if you want...
So you want to think of an antiferromagnet as a condensate of magnons?
Is yes,
that the idea?
This is an antiferromagnetic state, which is very trivial to prove because the antiferromagnetic order parameter is T dagger, so M or N is given by T dagger plus T. And since this is a coherent state, you have learned in quantum mechanics if you operate with such a bosonic operator onto this, this is an eigen operator. So this is an antiferromagnet.
But it's probably not a conventional antiferromagnet. So, I mean, it's probably not a conventional antiferromagnet.
It is? That's why I didn't understand.
Can you explain how you get the antiferromagnetic correlations out of a thing which looks as if the spins are parallelly?
I don't really want to spend time on this. You can convince yourself, for example, on a ladder, if you want. You can convince looking at the run states in the ladder, and let's say they are in a singlet configuration and you have spin up, spin down states here, then you can write the antiferromagnetic order parameter as a sum over these rung sites n, if this is n, e to the I, and this would be q, which is pi, the pi vector, and then you would have exactly this t dagger plus t operator, which gives you the triplet configurations. And this is an eigen operator of this RVB, which in the rung case would be a product of these singlets here. Okay? And now I want to confront this picture with the corresponding V-coupling or itinerant picture, which is the other extreme, and I'm sure you are more familiar with this. One could also say, okay, why don't I take my vacuum state as the Fermi liquid state? And then I would write down, for example, for the superconducting state, which I create via doping, the usual BCS variational form with the BCS variational parameters UK and VK, and this is the familiar Cooper pair operator. And if for the moment you allow me exactly in this spirit to replace the P Cooper pair operator by the triplet operator, this is the electron hole triplet excitation operator, I get, and I will prove this, but I think you are familiar with this, this is an antiferromagnetic state, so I'll come back later to this. So the main message I want to make is from a physics point of view, the SO5 theory, in our opinion, makes sense because what it does is, if you allow me to translate the building blocks of these many-body states, then I go over in a very natural way from the antiferromagnet to the superconductor. So good, but now I come to the problems. I haven't told you about problems. Okay, problems of the original description are, of course, there, and one problem is very obvious. You have you cannot have complete symmetry between hole pairs or electron pairs and spin properties. And this is evident because we have a huge charge gap. We have a mod gap of order 2 to 3 electron volts. But in the exact SO5 theory, then we would have a spin gap of the same order or size. And this is, of course, wrong. We know we have in 2D gapless spin excitations. So we really have to deal with the Mott Hubbard physics, and this is the main issue I will discuss here. And this has very early on actually shown up, and even people in this audience have partly criticized this picture. because what we initially were aiming at is verifying to what extent TJ and Hubbard models carry an SO5 symmetry. And as a recipe for checking whether the realistic models carry SO5 symmetry, we would go to the irreducible representations or the multiplet structure. And exactly like if you look at, for example, spin S equal 1 system and you expose it to a magnetic field, you would get a splitting in the SC values with equal distances, and this would correspond to a certain precession frequency and so on. But in SO5, since we go from the antiferromagnet to the superconductor, we not only have one coordinate which is SC, but we have a second coordinate which is the doping or Q. So we have a two-component multiplet structure, and if you like mathematics, this is a rank 2 algebra, the SO5. So what we were initially saying is, okay, take the TJ model, for example, or Hubbard model, and let's look at the lowest energy states and whether they fit into such a multiplet structure. And what we found for the TJ model was a surprise, namely the hole states, which are down here, these are the electronically filled states, the hole states fit very nicely into such an SO5 multiplet structure. So this was very nice. In fact, to an accuracy beta of J divided by 10, which is typically the superconducting gap. But early on, people, as I said, pointed out, and of course we knew that too, there is a problem, because in the real systems, such as the Hubbard type of systems or the Hubbard model, you have a huge gap to electronic filled states. This is the charge gap. And so the realistic multiplet structure has a gap, but the SO5 doesn't. And this is the main problem we have been dealing with in the last 2 years, and I'll discuss it. And there is actually an experiment, and this is the first part of my talk, which clearly points that this is a crucial thing. And the experiment is that the antiferromagnetic and superconducting gaps from photoemission and optics seem to be related, at least from photoemission, it's very clear. I will show you that the antiferromagnetic gap has a certain modulation on top of a huge S-wave background gap, and this modulation has nodes at exactly the same nodes as the superconducting gap, and in fact, we believe has an underlying D-wave-like symmetry, which I'll discuss in a minute, and this was published just very recently, and I will summarize this as my first part. The reason why I would like to choose this as the first part is, whether you like it or not, this calculation makes very clear what you have to do to correct for the physics in the SO5 picture. So it makes very clear what projection means, and that's why I would like to discuss that. Well, when I was in Stanford, the Shen group just came out with this experiment, which really triggered my interest, namely that they saw in the antiferromagnet, if they go along the magnetic Brillouin zone in photoemission, a pattern emerging, which is like an underlying D-wave symmetry, but it is on top of a background large gap contribution. And this, of course, was basically an experiment which was clear that we would get interested in, because it looked as if there's a relation with the superconducting gap having this D-wave symmetry. And what I would like to show you is that you can, in fact, prove in a few lines that there must be such a symmetry relation if I believe at all in such a projected SO5 description. It is then harder to really show a second feature of the experiments, namely this gap modulation is an order of magnitude larger than the gap magnitude of the superconductor, and that this comes out needs the projection. Because if I don't use the projected SO5, then also the antiferromagnet would, because of the symmetry between charge and spin, have nodes, and you know this is unphysical. So we have to deal with this.
Are you going to discuss the experiment in any more detail?
Yeah, I come to the experiment. In fact, the first sloppy picture I will show you now, but I will come back in much more detail. So the sloppy picture is this one, which was the initial picture of the Stanford paper, Namely, they measured the photoemission data along the magnetic burn zone, and then they found if they reference their data with respect to this nodal point pi over 2, pi over 2, and go with E of k along the magnetic Brillouin zone, and plot the difference with respect to this nodal point, they found if they plot it as a function of this D wave form factor, a linear dispersion. So this is what initially I mean by D wave-like or magnitude of D dependence. But I will come back to much more in much more detail to newer experiments.
And, all right, just so I, if I may, my question really is it clear that the experiment is inconsistent with all the old story about one hole in an antiferromagnet, which predicted a minimum, although not a linear cusp?
Yeah, in fact, I will exactly, if you give me about 15 minutes, hopefully, I'm not sure in view of my experience here in general, but let's say in about 15 minutes, I should be exactly at this point that it is in newer data, it's more quadratic here. So I'll come back to this in detail.
Will you also address the issue of the line shape and
photoemission? Not really, but I will, if you forgive me, I will more concentrate on his question. I will come back to recent.
So that's also pretty weird in the data.
Yeah, I agree, but I have no time to go into this. But we can discuss it later, because I will come back to this experiment. So let me just come back to this old idea, which I initially indicated, that, for example, in a Fermi liquid-like of description, I have these two variational states which hopefully describe a condensation process into the antiferromagnetic region, where I have here the building blocks as magnons, and I have a condensation process via doping where I create hole pairs, and they condense via this usual BCS-like variational state. So the question is, if I have such a type of description, what could I learn about photoemission? Isn't there already then also some connection between these order parameters of the antiferromagnet and the superconductor? And let me show you that we believe there is, and in fact, this is very simple. If I have this magnon, which creates particle hole excitations with respect to Hough filling, and if I have the Cooper pair, which creates my hole pair, say, with respect to Hough filling, then at first I would say, yes, I have really different states of matter. But as I said already in this sketchy thing here, if I replace, or if I could replace the magnon operator by the pair creation operator, then, and this is done by this pi rotation, I get in principle a physical connection. So the question is, what is this pi operator? And the pi operator is simply constructed out of simple quantum mechanics, because if I want to rotate from the magnon to the Cooper pair, then this rotation operator has to patch up the differences in the quantum numbers. So this is an S equal 1 operator, this is an S equal 0, so this has to be an S equal 1. This has no, or carries no charge, this carries charge 2, so this has to carry charge 2, and so on. So I could repeat the Su Sheng Tsang argument, and already, as discussed by him, this would fix this pi operator apart from a phase factor, and this phase factor is uniquely determined by the Lie algebra, by group closure, and has to be the sign of such a D-wave factor here. Okay, so this fixes this G of K. And now we can simply check whether we did our quantum mechanic 1 lecture correctly. Namely, we know in quantum mechanics that rotating means evaluating a commutator. So rotating from the antiferromagnet onto the superconducting order parameter means I have to evaluate this commutator. Pi is the rotation operator. And you see, I pick up on the right-hand side always this phase factor G of K, which is the sign of a D-wave factor. And similarly, I could do the adjoint rotation and rotate from the superconductor to the antiferromagnet, and I pick up this phase factor. But now I'm basically finished with the exact argument, because basically I could just say, if I have, and we know that this is there in experiment, a D waveform of the superconducting Cooper pair wave function, then this must translate into a magnitude D waveform of the Magnum wave function. And this means if I have a D wave superconducting gap, I would always have a magnitude D wave gap modulation in the interferometer.
Wait, I'm sorry. I realized then that there's something I missed. The conventional antiferromagnet.
Yes.
That everybody wrote down a long time ago, for example, the Shreefer, Wen, and Zhang, does not, if I remember correctly, have such a D wave modulation. Is that right? This is a slightly different antiferromagnet.
That's
than
correct.
The naive one which you would write down.
That's correct.
Okay.
Again, I will make this clear in a Hartee-Fock type of simple mean field evaluation. Okay. This brings me exactly now to the point, namely, so far I have shown a general argument, but now I come to this fact that actually in experiment, these magnitudes of the gaps and the modulation of the antiferromagnetic gap modulation are very different. This is of order J, and this is of order J divided by 10. So how does this come now about? And this comes about of the projection. So let me discuss it in detail.
So I have a question. In order to interpret these as gaps, I have to think in terms of some sort of Fermi surfaces, isonormal states. And for the superconductor, you can say that there are gapless excitations in an antiferromagnet, even in the normal state, even above the nil temperature.
Yes, let me make clear that I think you are asking an important question. Namely, in the photoemission experiment, you are, of course, only kicking out electrons. So you could argue, okay, what is this guy speaking about, a gap? Because in the photoemission, I'm measuring differences in energy, say, between pi 0 and pi over 2 as my reference point. Okay? And this I called a kind of gap modulation. Now, what is underlying here, and this is an assumption, if you like, a prediction also for the experimentalists, because no one has measured the optical gap k-dependent, we are assuming here electron-hole symmetry so that this modulation is translated into an actual gap modulation, okay? But this is an assumption, so we assume that there is a translation of the photoemission modulation into an actual gap modulation. So now let me come back to this effective Hamiltonian, and right away I would like to admit this is the approximate step of the story. This before was more or less an exact SO5 Taylor statement, but now I'm going to an effective Hamiltonian. So how would I describe such an effective Hamiltonian? Well, our idea was to say, okay, after all, we have found that the multiplets very closely within the order of J divided by 10, they follow this SO5 multiplet structure. So from our point of view, it makes sense to say there is a part of the Hamiltonian which is SO5 invariant. But we also know, this we have seen in the experiments, and also we have seen in the discussion of the Hubbard physics of the Hubbard model, that there are two symmetry-breaking terms which you just have to take into account. One is the chemical potential, because the chemical potential term will drive you away from any SO5 symmetric point by doping. And there's this huge energy scale, which we'll see on and on again, namely the Mott Hubbard energy scale. And this is embedded in, for example, the usual Hubbard U term. So as our effective Hamiltonian, we take precisely that. We take an SO5 invariant term, chemical potential, and Mott Hubbard term. Okay, what is the SO5 term? The SO5 term on this two-dimensional square lattice is a nearest neighbor hopping term, because this can trivially be shown to be SO5 invariant. And then we have some interaction term. Now again, at this point, you would say, okay, I can write 1,000 or a million terms here, which are SO5 invariant, because I have to construct all these scalar and tensor representations and whatnot. But this term is fixed by experiment. That's our philosophy. Why? Because our philosophy is, let's take the superconductor, which has a definite dx squared minus y squared property, and I know in the superconductor, for example, that I do not make a big mistake if I assume I have, for example, d x squared minus y squared nearest neighbor Cooper pairs, but I can extend this and I will later. So let's start from this BCS-like form for the superconductor as a starting point with nearest neighbor Cooper pairs. And this fixes this part of the SO5 interaction, the superconducting part. And it fixes this parameter which is fitted to experiment. This is the only parameter I have in the theory. This is the strength of this interaction. And this is fitted to experiment. The rest has to be automatically fulfilled because I rotate from SO5 from this part onto this part, which is the triplet-triplet or magnon-magnon interaction part. And so let's just check what this does for me.
I'm sorry, but before you go on, there's one respect in which that is different from the usual BCS wave function, namely that here you've summed over all k in the bottom line there.
Okay.
I could imagine that there's something which restricts me to the neighborhood of some Fermi surface. Is that a trivial point, or does it make a difference?
This can make a difference. This, what I do here, to be very precise, is the reduced nearest neighbor BCS form in a separable ansatz.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We have studied this in various extensions, but I will present today to you the Hartree-Fock or S-slave boson solution of this part.
I guess a philosophical question.
Okay.
The Mott Hubbard term breaks the symmetry back down to SU2 cross U1, presumably. The whole Hamiltonian now only has an SU2 cross U1 symmetry.
In the SO5, it breaks it down to a much more complicated structure. That's exactly what.
Let me ask you a very simple question. What is the what are the global symmetries of the black age? You've made it black.
This year?
What are the global symmetries of that Hamiltonian? A simple question. What are they? What is this global symmetry?
The symmetry, there is not a universal symmetry group anymore left.
But it's is it not U1 cross SU2?
No, it is not. I can show you, and I will right now, that the dynamical correlation functions do not carry any longer the full SO5 symmetry, not even at the SO5 symmetric.
Let me rephrase my question. How many operators can you show commute with that Hamiltonian? Is it just the operators that are the conserved quantities of SU2 cross U1, or
no,
are there more?
It's four, but I hesitate to say four because this is a complicated issue to which I will come back in the bosonic description. There you will see very naturally that we change from five bosons, two for the charged bosons, holes and pairs, and three for the triplets to four bosons. And there I can answer this
group
question.
Group theory tells you the ways you can break SO5 down. There are only a certain number of ways you can break SO5 down. So you should then tell us which way it's broken by that term.
Well, it is broken in a non-trivial manner so that I have four non-trivial objects left. Yeah?
Group theory doesn't tell you there aren't any non-trivial ways to do it. There's just a certain number of ways of breaking the symmetry SO5 down.
There is a point in doping, or to be precise, let me answer your question in a different way. I will show you hopefully 15 minutes, that there exists a critical chemical potential. At this point, I have still the old SO5 symmetry restored. Okay, if I go away from this critical chemical potential, the SO5 symmetry is broken, and group theory tells you some general statements if you're very close about Goldstone modes, and I will show you that.
It seems to me that the symmetry of H is SU2 cross U1.
I think that kind of used to be there.
That is there, but there's something...
So you've broken the symmetry in a major way. You've broken the symmetry down by a huge term, green term.
That's right.
And so once you've broken the symmetry down to SU2 cross U1, it seems to me that why should you therefore continue to use the SO5 principle to constrain H into interaction?
I will show it. I will promise I come back to this, but I can already indicate this to you, but I will come back to this. But let me jump way ahead of what I wanted to do at this point, since you insist on it. I give you a physical idea what is really happening.
Can't you just answer this using group theoretic language?
Because the group theoretical language gives you an exact answer, and this is correct at only one point in the doping space, namely mu c. Okay? And this I can verify to you in simple physical terms. This is the chemical potential, okay? And what SO5 in general does, it did, or so far did, it did a symmetric rotation on the whole space and on double occupied electronic spaces. This is a problem. This is exactly the charge gap problem we discussed, and introduces this asymmetry with a spin gap. So naively, you could say, okay, I can repair this, and now you see why a specific chemical potential comes into play. I lower my chemical potential to the top of the valence band. And then for whole states only, I have repaired the problem because I have no longer a charge gap for whole pairs, and I have no spin gap if I do the SO5 rotation. But you see, I have a huge gap for these doubly occupied electronic whole pairs, and then I have to project out. This is the whole idea here. And at exactly this chemical potential, I restore the full SO5 symmetry, and I'll show you that. But if you go away from that, for example, down here, then the SO5 symmetry is broken by the chemical potential, and that's just it.
So the statement is that if I take the black Hamiltonian you originally wrote down, set mu equal to minus u, that Hamiltonian now has complete SO5
symmetry. Exactly. Okay. But I will come back again to this, I hope, in 15 minutes. Okay, so I have to... Well, I'll show it to you.
All right.
Okay, so let's first finish the fermionic part. The fermionic part, I indicated, has these two symmetry breaking terms plus the SO5 term. So now I said, if this theory has anything to do with reality, I should be able to avoid it relatively simple. And the simplest way to do this is Hartree-Fock mean field. Of course, we can do more accurate things, but we have done this as to illustrate the idea here. So BCS is described by the usual order parameter of the gap. And in Hartree-Fock, the description of the anti-ferromagnet is just STW, where the tuplet order parameter is related to the gap and to this energy, which in both cases contains the bare energy, for example, the cosine band, plus the gap feature. Now, the point I would like to make here is, in both these simple cases, you have exactly the same gap equation, where the kernel, however, is very different, this interaction part. Okay? What is the interaction part? Well, in the superconductor, I just illustrated this, I take V times this separable form for the BCS, which is of nearest neighbor form, where you want to make it more complicated. Since this is separable, you have learned in mathematics, you can trivially solve this integral equation. This is the solution by hand. And you get that this superconducting gap has a scaling with this D-wave form factor. And of course, I have fitted V to the experiment, so no wonder it has the right magnitude. The crucial question comes now, what happens now to the antiferromagnet? Because here I have fixed everything. Okay, the antiferromagnet, because it doesn't have the plus minus complete D-wave symmetry, and I showed you it has this magnitude of D-wave symmetry, no longer erases the U, so the U enters the antiferromagnet, but I still have a separable magnitude of D-dependent interaction energy on top of it. Again, you can solve this by hand, you don't need anything. And the solution is also obvious. The solution is I have a background energy of order U, which I have also in experiment, and I have a modulation which goes like 1 over U and is of order J. Okay? So this is in agreement, overall agreement with experiment. And
I have I'm sorry, can you explain a little more what went into this calculation? I guess what concerns me is there a lower energy Hartree-Fock state for the antiferromagnet which doesn't have this mod D business? Because that mod D business is not in the usual one, and I want to know what got in here.
That I cannot rule out. I mean, this is a Hartree-Fock treatment. What we did is we did also a slave boson treatment. I'll show the data.
But so therefore, just to be precise,
precise, this is a Hartree-Fock treatment where first you construct the superconducting state.
Right.
Then you apply your SO5 rotation
exactly.
to generate an antiferromagnetic
exactly.
state.
Yes.
And then you evaluate its gap, which
exactly.
is the U in this medium.
Absolutely.
So it leaves open the question of whether there's a better energy
yes.
antiferromagnetic
yes.
state.
Yes.
Thank you. So wait, you put in your potential P
yes.
and P prime.
Yes.
That's your microscopic potential. And I think
plus U.
Yeah, that thing there. And so you might not be so surprised if this state is the lowest energy state for that, because that's not your usual potential for the antiferromagnet.
Well, yeah, but at the moment,
it's some complicated long-range potential. Isn't that right?
No. I cannot rule it out. Let's make
no,
it.
No, I know you can't rule it out, but I'm just saying that he
could
be surprised.
Yes.
If it isn't
because
the interaction that
because this has an extra interaction, it's
yes.
plausible that state is the lowest
but
energy
you,
state.
If I just took nearest neighbor U and V and used the usual Hartree-Fock state on it, it would still give you the same dispersion for the quasi-particles.
It would still give you the same superconductor, but it
right.
would give you a different...
Yes.
No, if I took just a Néel state as my variational state, and then ask what that does...
No, you never see absolute value of V in the dispersion.
Okay.
No,
that's new.
No, I'm agreeing with you.
Okay.
It would not show up.
Right.
V wouldn't change that.
So we can check also on your idea. There's a very crucial check, because the point is, I can now check whether this projection idea, and this is really the physics behind it, works, because the point is, this looks nearly too simple to be true, so let's check whether the projection is correct, okay? So what we did is, and in the meantime, we did all kinds of numerical treatments as well, so this is this trivial analytical treatment, where I evaluate now the gap modulation, which I've just analytically done in Hartree-Fock, or SDW. We have done slave boson, we have done all kinds of numerical things, and it always saturates, and it better does so. So the idea is, you see, if I make U larger and larger, it should saturate to a finite value here. And you see, I have reached the finite value of at about U equals 8T, which also makes roughly sense. So the projection means I project out the higher energy states in the more turret physics. Now I'm coming back to more detailed experiments, because you could say, okay, how about the superconducting gap, which is measured here as an angle around pi over 2, pi over 2, which shows a more curvy-like behavior. And already, even if you look at this figure and you confront it with the figure of the Shen data, and admittedly, this is a different material, this is an insulator, but nevertheless, you find that there are obvious things which somehow match. But please realize that the magnitude is J divided by 10 times smaller than this here. And we have addressed the question, how are the superconducting newer data, which I just showed you, affecting the antiferromagnetic gap as well. So we can fit in a more refined manner, involving higher order harmonics or longer ranged interactions, the data to whatever accuracy you want. And then we can rotate. And for example, if you take a third nearest neighbor form, which fits the green line here, you get this quadratic behavior. In the simple slave boson evaluation. So you can do better and better, but the overall statement I would like to make is, we have a very clear symmetry statement that SO5 predicts an interrelation between the superconducting gap D-wave symmetry and this antiferromagnetic magnitude of D modulation here. And the projection is very crucial to give you these different magnitudes, or the U term is very important. Okay, I could also go into details if someone is interested, because what are then the effects of these famous T prime and T double prime nasty band structure parameters people have used. We believe they come out in mean field very nicely from the antiferromagnetic part of this interaction. If you take just the mean field evaluation of this antiferromagnetic part of the SO5 interaction, you get T primes, T double primes, longer range neighbor hoppings, which have the right sign and within a few percent are in the numerical values previously obtained. But the difference is, we can naturally connect this to the order of J. So in our approach, this is clearly a magnetic T prime effect, and this, in our opinion, has some crucial of things to say. Okay, so let me summarize this first thing. So basically, we believe that these experiments give some crucial tests for any microscopic theory, and obviously also for us. And in particular, that also not only the symmetry, but also the magnitudes are radically connected.
Werner, before you leave, is it fair to ask, what if one goes on now and measures the sequence of systems, YBCO, VSCO, LSCO? Does SO5 have a problem if one doesn't see this type of pattern repeating itself? Or is it your opinion there's enough room, wiggle room to get out of this?
Okay, I will also say some negative points, really will, about SO5, because we have, for example, measured, this is the second part now, the pi-pi excitations, the famous Newton scattering mode. And this is not in accordance with the overdoped data of Keimer, for example. And now Su Sheng Zhang has explanations that J is modified with doping. I do not honestly believe that this is an explanation. I think SO5 eventually breaks down because of many, many reasons.
I guess I was wondering, though, just with the angular result photo emission.
If you go higher doping.
No, if we have enough data.
I'm wondering
in these systems if there is enough. I'm wondering if this type of gap modulation in the antiferromagnetic state is...
Well, I mean, as long as there's a minimum in the gap, it's always going to have the same pattern, right? Even in this case, cutting along the magnetic zone boundary is not clear why would I want to be doing that. I mean, there's no...
But everybody who ever studied one hole in a Heisenberg model got the lowest energy excitation along pi-pi and the highest along pi-zero. Presumably, many of those excitations have absolutely nothing to do.
That's correct.
With SO5. But the crucial feature is that it vanishes linearly.
Exactly. But also the magnitude, that there is an order factor 10 difference.
No, but let's leave aside superconductivity for a second. Everybody who studied a hole in the Heisenberg model got a modulation of the order of J, right?
That was the problem. The problem was nobody got it until they put in T prime.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Pi over two, pi
yeah,
over two,
exactly.
Pi
this, Doug, thank you for this remark. This is what Doug said is very important, so this is why I actually addressed this T prime issue. All the numerical people and people in my group as well, we did all the time put in the T prime to repair this effect. Now I'm telling you the T prime, at least from our point of view, has a totally different many body physics explanation.
Well, what I'm wondering about is, presumably have more and better data now on electron-doped materials. By that I mean angular result photo emission data. Mm-hmm. Perhaps a set of rather clean materials.
Mm-hmm.
It would strike me that if you want to make this statement as strong as you have somehow, mm-hmm. that SO5 could rise or fall on how well we see this repeated in other materials.
Yeah, I made that
in the undoped version of other materials, because the D wave symmetry of the gap in the superconducting state is presumably robust past SO5.
I want to understand whether it won't kill it. If you start making more and more measurements and you don't find the relationship that we've just seen.
Yeah,
but in the superconducting state, at least I don't think you're interested in killing out D wave symmetry.
No.
Okay, and so the nodal structure of the gap in the superconducting state is also just a consequence of the D wave symmetry.
Right.
The special thing is in the undoped antiferromagnets. So you're asking about the parent states of these.
Okay, so Doug, make
other materials.
Doug, make
the undoped versions.
Undoped versions of.
Yeah, can I make this?
Steve's right. I don't want to. I just want to take LSCO if I could. I want to take LCO. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I want to take YBCO. Well, this is sorry. This is part of
this is VSCO. Why not do undoped VSCO?
Sure, absolutely. We can. So
just one different undoped ones.
But Doug, we can finish this very quickly. I mean, the answer to your point is yes. I mean, as simple as that. We have a very definite interrelation with this feature, and it's a gap interrelation. So already we make a prediction about the gap, but so far only photoemission has been measured. And if this breaks down, then we are really in trouble. This is a very clear test of SO5 theory. Point. That's there. For different materials, yes.
I just wanted to hear it, because my feeling is the way things evolve in theory is one will find a way out of this as soon as we get a real...
No, but...
I was just curious how you felt.
So it's on recorded.
Yes. There's at least someone in the background who also made a very clear statement that if the experiment is not fulfilled, in his case, then the theory is out. Okay.
But the question is, when you address this issue of the gap in the superconducting state and the gaps in the antichromagnetic and so on, using photo emissions, but I mean, the same photo emission data, there's another striking difference between the superconducting and the antichromagnetic,
right.
Namely that there's a sharp polyparticle peak inside the superconductor, but apparently, the data in the antichromagnetic doesn't look anything like that at all.
Let's discuss that later, because we have worked on this issue, but I didn't want to discuss it now. Let me instead go to the quickly second part of my talk, which is I would like to describe an effective bosonic model, which I'm sure Zhusheng Zhang has mentioned, but we have solved it exactly in the meantime. So what is the basic idea? The basic idea is that, for example, if I consider a ladder as my toy object, I could describe the excitations in the rung in the form of a singlet, which gives me the vacuum state, in the form of triplets, which have an energy delta S, and in terms of particle and hole pairs, which have a radically different energy by 4 times mu, if this is the one particle chemical potential. And then you can achieve exact SO5 symmetry by saying that the fluctuations between this singlet vacuum state and the triplet, so this energy difference, has to be identical to this fluctuation from the singlet to both these pair states. And then you, which is this here. And at first you would say, how can this ever happen? Because I need obviously here an energy of 2U, 2 times the Hubbard U, to cross over this difference in energy. And this is, of course, a major problem. And what we did in an early work with Doug Scalapino, and more detail in this work with Robert Eder, is we first amended or augmented the Hamiltonian, which I just discussed for a rung, and then we translated to a ladder by new terms, which are nearest neighbor terms within Coulomb form within the rung, and then more extended exchange terms within the rung. And unfortunately, I believe that this is a very unphysical solution of the problem, because when you do this, you get an exact SO5 description, which forces you to choose this interaction to be 4 times U plus V. And for the positive small j's, this means that V is very negative and unphysical. And this is exactly what we no longer want to do. What we want to do is we want to confine ourselves to the whole states, Q smaller than 0, and project out the quantum fluctuations to these electronic states which have this huge energy 2U. So this is again this idea of the projection. And if you do this in a perturbation theoretical treatment, you would say, okay, I get a shift in the energies due to these quantum fluctuations in the electronically occupied states, which has a chemical potential shift going with the charge. And then I have a characteristic energy, which is this excitation energy squared. So this can be done in a rather elegant fashion. Oops, and now I probably don't find my... Yeah, here I have it. Rather elegant fashion, which was... we had the physics idea, but elegantly, as usually, it was done by Zhusheng Zhang. And let me show you what his idea there was in this paper, which has appeared in the meantime. So you could say, okay, as I already said, I can lower the chemical potential to get the symmetry between spin and charge excitations for the whole sector, but in the electronic sector, I have this very high energy, so I would like to project it out. How am I going to do this? Well, if you look at the 5-dimensional superspin order parameter, you know basically what you have to do, because the real part of the superconducting order parameter involves the hole pairs, but you have also fluctuations to the electronic pairs, and similar for the imaginary part. So sort of pictorially, I have to cross these fluctuations out. And this very naturally changes the commutation relation. Initially, the commutation relation between Q1 and Q5 was zero. Because I've projected this out, and this was Su Sheng's idea, it is I divided by 2. And this takes exactly into account projecting out these fluctuations. Okay, and there's, I have no time, there's formal analogy to the lowest Landau level projection of Laughlin. But I'm not going to discuss it.
What about the new symmetry group?
As I said, at this point, it is, now I come to exactly your point, it is SO5, but if I go away, it's broken. Okay? So what is the idea here? The idea is that I have an effective bosonic Hamiltonian which contains the creation energy of the triplets, and here, and I'm sure Su Sheng Tsang has described this to you, the X denotes a plaquette, so basically you have to go in a coarse grain fashion from a picture with the rungs, you have to go to plaquettes describing the two-dimensional system. There is problems, in my opinion, there is still lots of work to be done. I do not fully understand this projection because there are some terms which I would like further to study, but let's assume that this projection onto these plaquettes is already correct. So this describes a plaquette at position x in the two-dimensional space which carries a triplet excitation with this energy. This carries a hole pair with this energy or formation, and of course I have some doping term which gets me more and more into the hole doped superconducting states. And this is the propagation energy of the triplets and of the hole pairs. Okay, and these are the corresponding order parameters. And if I choose, coming back to your point, if I choose this mu to be such that these creation energies are identical, and this happens precisely at the top of the valence band when I first dope into the superconducting state, then if I also choose these conditions for the coupling constants, you see that all these objects can be mutually interchanged, and then you are at the SO5 symmetric point.
Can you explain this a little more? Unless it's because naively, if I look at that Hamiltonian, it would appear to have matrix elements which give me states like what you're trying to project out. Right, the propagation term could kill a whole pair at one site and create a whole pair at another site where there's already a hole.
Yes.
So this matrix element looks like it's not, this Hamiltonian H,
yes,
looks like it's not projected.
This Hamiltonian is projected.
How do I see that projection? It's like T dagger H will create has the danger of creating a doubly occupied site.
If you allow me to do this, I have this done in detail, and can we sit down later?
Okay.
Just believe me, because I would love to describe this on a ladder and go exactly through all these excitations. The idea is we use a Gopalan-Rice-Siegrist type of description of the hardcore bosons describing the triplets, and they are augmented by the charge bosons for the hole pairs and for the electron pairs. And then you have also an interaction term, which I left completely out, but it is there and contains all the terms which you have addressed,
okay.
And this plays a role. But
right, so basically there's terms which are not visible in that.
Exactly. So,
okay. Going back to my question earlier, since this is a good time to go back to it, you claim that for a certain choice of chemical potential,
yes,
that the black Hamiltonian was SO5 symmetric.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're telling me is that without any projection, I can take that Hamiltonian, set mu to the right value, and commute it with all the operators of SO5, and I will get zero. Is that what you're telling me? So we can check that out.
Yeah, you can check that out, sure.
Werner, you know, Pierre wasn't here for Su Cheng's talk, but Su Cheng had a very simple...
And if I find that answer, we'll...
Yes.
But
we can sit down if you want to do this.
Non-commutivity means that the coordinates... make the consequences of the symmetry a little unfamiliar. The example Su Ching gave is consider an electron in the lowest Landau level. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now the system's translationally invariant, but that doesn't mean that your eigenstates are momentum eigenstates, because the x and y coordinates don't commute with each other. And so it's still fully translationally invariant, but you have non-commutative space or something like that.
Well, that's all very nice, but I can go back to some very simple foundations of group theory, and I can say if a Hamiltonian has a certain symmetry, then it commutes with the generators of that symmetry group. Now, we know what they are in this case.
Yes.
It's very simple. We can just take mu equal to the value that that he's quoting.
Yes.
Is what, by the way?
You may need to do H.
So we can do all this business, H commuting with pi or pi dagger, and we can check whether we get this omega pi times pi or pi dagger, where this is, for example, the resonating energy in the Newton scattering. This has, you can check, this is all obeyed.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
What value of mu is that, by the way?
This is this value where first time, I will show you now in numerical calculation, where first time dope into the superconducting or create whole pairs. Yes. Okay, so what was the mean field result which we had about a year ago? The mean field result we had a year ago is schematically shown here. We had a coexistence region. This was a change towards the old exact SO5 description, a coexistence region of anti-ferromagnetic and superconducting behavior. And this was a consequence of the chemical potential to being as a function of doping or density constant up to this critical value. And in this mu C regime, I have the SO5 symmetry, and then the chemical potential would change with doping. And let's just see, because this mean field treatment didn't have an actual small parameter, what would happen if we do it in a more or less exact fashion. And I'm sorry, I have practically no time left, but let me just give you a flavor of that. So basically, flavor is we have, I have a student, Ansgar Dorner, who did these calculations together with a student at the, or not a student, a professor at the ETH, Matthias Troyer, and they have come with a very powerful evaluation of an idea which is due to Anders Sandvik, namely a new type of quantum Monte Carlo stochastic series expansion. And I have no time to go into this if somebody is interested, but we believe that this is a completely new quality of quantum Monte Carlo simulations. And let me just get your appetite working in the sense that people here are interested, in Heisenberg models. So for example, you can, with this technique, with a workstation running, typical workstation of 1 hour, you can solve a Heisenberg model with several thousand solids. Why is this possible? Because the computational time does no longer scale like in usual quantum Monte Carlo procedures. This has to do with the update, which is very non-local also. It doesn't scale with the power 3 cube, n solids cube, but with this very small power. And this makes it a very attractive technique, and it doesn't have the discretization error of the standard split-up, trotter split-up technique, and therefore we have a very powerful way of evaluating. This is basically an exact evaluation of this quantum nonlinear sigma model. So let me just show you what we get. We get, for example, for mu, for the density versus mu, we get, if we go really cool, that we no longer get this very sharp transition, mu C constant, but we get a rounded transition. This is the superconducting regime, as you will see in a minute, and this is basically the anti-ferromagnetic regime here.
Which model is this?
This is this Hamiltonian bosonic model, which I just discussed.
Okay.
So we evaluate this now exactly. We can this is this behavior of the doping versus mu, is in our opinion interesting because there are experiments reflecting such a behavior. You know that in the superconductors, like in this LSCO compound, the chemical potential is pretty much constant up to nearly optimal doping, and only then it takes off. So this shows a strong similarity to this mu versus doping behavior I indicated. Now, next point is we can evaluate the phase diagram or the SO5 symmetric point. Are you here? The SO5 symmetric point. We can evaluate. So what we do is we look for the correlation functions, and if they have the same correlation length, this is the requirement of SO5, and this is given by the blue and red signals here, then we can plot the phase diagram in T and mu. And here they have the same correlation line. And we can do this also differently, namely we know that we have to have a Kostelitz-Daulis type of transition here. And here you see the enormous accuracy of this calculation. These are basically the error points here. And so we know, for example, if we look at these functions as function of the density of triplets or whole pairs, as they scale with the distance and with the number of sites, or here the temperature. For example, here we see at a certain value of temperature and mu that we have in the charge sector, we have algebraic behavior, so we have quasi-long-range order, and in the magnetic channel we have no Lagrange order. So this is, it means we are in the superconducting sector here. And this can be mapped out, and then we get this phase diagram. So this phase diagram means that here we have temperature versus mu in units of this coupling J, which I introduced in my Hamiltonian. And blue means I have an exponential decay of the correlation functions. Red means I have a power law decay. And I get the corresponding Kostelitz-Daulis transition here. And in order to convince you that this is extremely accurate, I can show you a typical finite size scaling analysis. So we can distinguish, my student could distinguish between, for example, here, an exponential decay versus a power law decay. So he fits this to an exponential, which is this here, and he can clearly distinguish a power law decay. He's now doing this for three-dimensional systems, and there we can discuss critical behavior and critical exponents. And for example, you see here in a logarithmic plot, that this is clearly exponential here. Okay, so last not least, he could also calculate, just to give you an idea, the pi resonance. This is my last point here. So you can calculate the relation with the spin Newton scattering experiments. And the idea is that here charge and spin are related. And if you look at the pi response function, then in SO5 you get the spin resonance as a resonance peak. And this is his data. So he gets in the mu space where the superconducting transition temperature or Kostelitz-Daulis temperature had this behavior, he gets a continuous increase here. And this is the strength under the peak. So this is the peak weight. And there are some experiments. So this is now a weak point at this point, which seem to indicate that here the Newton peak goes down. So this is a thing we are working on. It could also be that the SO5 description breaks down eventually here. I don't know. So this is an open question here. And this refers to basically your questions. There are more terms in the Hamiltonian, which we have not treated yet, and we have to look at them. They give rise to frustration in these hoppings between the bosons, and we are investigating this. So let me just...
The last point there, I thought that was an important point, but I'm not sure I understand what you said.
Oh, this last point is interesting because what...
No, the black bullet.
The bottom bullet. The bottom bullet, what are you saying there? Some peak weight.
Excuse me.
Normal state.
I'm sorry.
Third.
It's here?
Yeah.
Okay, so what he found is that in the normal state, he finds a persistence of some weight in this of this peak here. So this is clearly fluctuation induced because he treats fluctuations in this model exactly, both thermal and quantum fluctuations. But I do not want to place too much emphasis on these data. In the underdog regime, he gets the usual thing which Su Sheng Zhang has pointed out several times, namely that there is an increase of the peak with TC, and essentially this means with doping, and that in the peaks we find there is an inverse behavior with 1 over TC for the total strength of the weight under the peak. So he gets this here, like in the experiments, in the underdoped regime. But we have some problems here in the overdoped regime if we believe some of the Keimer experiments. So this summarizes basically what I wanted to tell you, namely that in the fermionic part, we have indications that a projected SO5 description gives a radically simple explanation of some of the experiments, but we will see whether future experiments can disprove this. And in the bosonic part, we get a phase diagram exactly evaluated for this quantum nonlinear sigma model, which at least has many signs of the actual phase diagram of high TC compounds. So I am still very optimistic. Thank you for your attention.
Steve wants me to back down on the antiferromagnets because maybe they'll all look the same for some general chemical reason. But is there a problem with, again, what you showed us in the data, with the curvature that comes in to the supposed node in the antiferromagnetic?
If this is an equal pair, I have to take the square root of the square root of this plus.
Let me make it very clear. You get this cusp-like feature. Are we speaking about this cusp here?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. This cusp as a straight line here, plotted versus this, comes up automatically if I take for my D wave form factor a BCS nearest neighbor cosine kx minus cosine ky. As soon as I include, in addition to this, which we did here, for example, higher order harmonics, I get this behavior here, quadratic type of behavior.
For kx close to ky, it's
still one of the linear terms
Is it because you plot it as a function of cosine kx minus cosine ky.
Linear plus quadratic.
Yeah, it's not quadratic.
There is a finite slope at zero, right?
Yeah, it looks like it still has a finite slope at zero with a curve at 0.5. But
you can imagine how you'd never resolve that.
Yeah.
Don't trick me out with the simple algebra. It's too simple.
Seemed to me one of Zhang's arguments for this whole picture was the neutron structure and the resonance.
Yeah.
And we learned subsequently that there are also incommensurate peaks and they seem to be very strongly correlated with the resonance. And I know Zhang gave us a little spiel, but I can't remember it.
Yes, I can tell you.
The origin of the incommensurate peaks. Could you?
Yes, what he believes, but I'm not so convinced, so we are not always agreeing. He wants to add terms of this structure. I can tell you the physics of these terms is frustration. This is basically exchanging in such a ladder picture. You have a singlet here, and you have, say, a triplet here. And if you change the singlet with the triplet, this creates a minus sign. This is simple commutation relation. And this gives a minus, actually, term here, which works against the positive terms which we had before in this bosonic picture. He has a calculation done by the student who is absolutely here. Where is he? Mr. Hu. And we have still to verify that his approximation and the rigorous calculation agree. I am not completely convinced that this is the right solution to this problem, but we will see. There are other interaction terms which we did not yet attack in this mapping onto the bosonic. The bosonic model has not just the T dagger T, but has T dagger T terms. Okay? And they were left out on the basis of randomization group argument because we were saying they have a scaling, they are introducing higher order time derivatives. And if you put the Fermi velocity equal to 1, then time and length scale are the same. So if length scale goes to infinity at the transition, it means all the time derivatives shouldn't contribute. But again, this holds only at the transition point in the critical regime. If you go away, I think these terms are relevant. And we are presently studying them.
So I ask about this. In this projected Hamiltonian, this effective Hamiltonian, is there actually a continuous transition from the antiferromagnetic phase
to the superconducting phase as your very terms of tension, or?
Well, this in Minfeld, this is a first order transition, and this is modified in a very important manner, actually, if you do this calculation. Let me just tell you that, for example, in the superconducting state, I had it on one of my few graphs, we do find magnons, and there's a substantial part of triplet excitations reaching into the superconducting state. In mean field, there's an abrupt loss of the magnon excitations in the superconducting state, and this has also all kinds of physical consequences.
But then, is it obvious that the first order transition has to be taking place when the chemical potential is at this magic value?
Well, it's not obvious, but we can show that there exists a chemical potential also in the numerical work where we have precisely restored SO5 symmetry. So that was his question, and that is this point mu c, where in the presence of all the interactions, we do first time dope into the valence band and create hole pairs. This point still exists. But I'm telling you, if I go away from this, I do not completely shut off, for example, the magnons. They spell into the superconducting regime, whereas the mean field solution carries no magnons whatsoever in the superconducting regime.
Can I ask you just to clarify that statement slightly? Was that a statement about the Hubbard model or about this bosonic?
No, this is this bosonic.
Okay, thank you. That's all I wanted to know.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Would you venture a speculation where the Hamiltonian is supposed to come from, like what you started about, which is obviously not going to work?
Well, we have a sporty fight with, for example, Doug, not only on the tennis court, but he seems more to believe, I think, if I may so say that TJ and Hubbard do the right things. I am convinced they don't do the right things. And I'm convinced that, for example, long-range Coulomb, on which we are also working, play a very definite role in this game. And we have to also supplement these type of ideas with the long-range Coulomb interaction,
which would also strongly break SO5, right?
Yeah.
Because it has to make the gold standard the super.
Exactly.
So this is an open issue. TJ, we have some idea of what is that comes from basic electronic structure, et cetera, et cetera. What's, where is this from? Who ordered this? Where is this coming from?
The long-range Coulomb?
No, the quote-unquote that edge.
You want to know where this bosonic model comes from, or what?
Because the black edge was just more or less the Hubbard model.
Yeah.
The first term is black.
What Dietart's asking. I'm sorry.
Okay.
In one dimension, you can basically, you can start from a microscopic model and derive that between.
So you want to know how this bosonic model is derived, or? I don't want to go into this, but if you want, I can.
I think Mark's maybe saying one could imagine that your delta-delta adjoint came from a factor, from a rewriting of the J minus JS I dot SJ, if you wanted to.
Yeah.
You could imagine that. But maybe he's asking, where's the next term come from? Particularly as it has presumably some fairly long-range pieces in it, unless I'm misremembering it. So maybe the question is, where did the M?
Yeah, but I indicated where this comes from. This comes from, at least in my opinion, from a strong similarity of superconducting and antiferromagnetic states. In my opinion, they are not very different. They are having the same type of construction. This is the basic issue why I am interested in SO5. If I hadn't realized that, I would be with you. I have given up. This is my opinion.
But I guess the question, though, was from a perhaps quantum chemical point of view, does one have any insight as to where the M term.
Okay, I can also a little bit comment on this. The quantum chemistry, you know only too well because you have really worked extensively on this, that the three-band Hubbard model is different from the physics to a certain extent from the one-band Hubbard model. The three-band Hubbard model has bonding and interbonding P plus D and P minus D state combinations, and they give in a very natural way rise to something like a possible mapping onto this rung type of issue. In the rung, and also in this construction of the bosonic model, we always had a pairing, if you like, or we had two type of states, namely a plus, a bonding, and an anti-bonding combination. And this seems to be a very important issue which is missed in the one-band Hubbard model, but for example would be found in a three-band Hubbard model. So, but this is a very interesting issue. Is there, from a chemical point of view, a mapping onto some of these ideas? I only wanted to tell you my strong motivation comes from the observation that anti-ferromagnetic and superconducting states, after all, formally can be very similarly described. And this is an observation which, in my opinion, is behind the whole SF5 idea.
I mean, but all condensed states can be written like that.
Yeah, but I now also tell you there is a definite, so to speak, rotation from this to this, namely from the triplets to the Cooper pairs, and at least ideally, this transition, this pi rotation, commutes with the Hamiltonian. At least it does so at the SF5 symmetric point. This is an additional point.
Can you comment on the fact that you have to add some T prime in the simulations?
No, I didn't add any T prime. Yeah. But I wanted to make the point that these fitting parameters come out, if you like, in a natural manner out of this SF5 symmetric Hamiltonian. So if I do a mean field factorization of this SF5 part, I don't find it, but basically, if I take this part and take a mean field evaluation, since this is an electron hole hopping process, I get T prime, T double prime effects. And I just don't believe that it is coincidence that they are having exactly the same sign and the same magnitude as all the fittings done by people like Robert Eder and many others. That was the
issue. But the point is that presumably the various people who studied one hole in the TJ model numerically got essentially the correct answer for that model.
For that model, yes.
Right. And therefore, that model is different from this.
Yes, that's
right. That, so the statement is that there is some other model which is neither the TJ model nor the TT prime J model.
Exactly.
Model, to look like the TT prime J model.
Yeah. I'm saying TJ is not enough.
Oh, correct.
Right. That's exactly correct. So, Catherine, can I ask you, are we finished, or what is the general idea?